So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Scott Bryan. On the show today, broadcasters around the world cover the death of Queen Elizabeth II. We take a look at how the media carried this cultural moment. Across the Atlantic, we take a look at the Emmys. Warner Brothers' discovery was triumphant. So why are they downsizing? Plus, Google is facing a new major lawsuit for anti-competitive conduct. Will UK news publishers benefit? And in the media quiz, we remember some of Her Royal Majesty's favourite shows, tunes and flicks. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. Matt Deegan is still away this week. We all wish him well. And before we bring on our guest for this week, let's have a look at the news. Podcast and audio subscription service Podimo has raised 58 million euros to fund international expansion. Patreon laid off 80 employees, including its Dublin and Berlin offices, as well as the entirety of its security team. Head of policy, Ellen Satterwhite, responded to user worries by saying the company works with external organisations to, quote, develop our security capabilities and conduct regular security assessments. And the passing of the Queen led to historic audience numbers for UK news brands. Some UK national newspapers had the biggest traffic since the 2020 US election, whilst The Guardian said that its story announcing the Queen's death has become its most read standalone news story of all time. We'll be taking some time to reflect on the historical moment and the news of the last week in the second part of today's media podcast. But first, I have two special guests with me to analyse this week's breaking media headlines. First up, it's the guy from the TV Pilot podcast, Boyd Hilton. Hello, Boyd.
Hello, Scotty.
How are you? What have you been up to this week?
I am very well. I'm enjoying the view of your bedroom on the... which, sadly, listeners, don't get that treat. Although, obviously, we're used to seeing you day in, day out on the BBC breakfast, etc. Anyway, so yeah, I'm very well. Thank you.
Thanks, man. What I love is that I have positioned the camera for the media podcast, but it's where I do all podcasting, within my bedroom cupboard. It's a bad joke, this, but it's been the first time I've been in the closet for about 15 years. We also have Edelman's UK planning director, Karen Robinson. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Scott. Nice to see you.
Lovely to see you. It's been a massive big week in the news. What's it been like viewing the reaction of the Queen's death from an American perspective?
Well, as a naturalised citizen of the UK as well, I'm seeing it from both perspectives. Obviously, I'm somebody who had to swear an allegiance to Her Majesty, so it's been fascinating to watch. Obviously, the Queen's death is a huge story in the US as well. People absolutely can't get enough of it. They love it. But in the States, there's much less of the... I guess there's sorrow, but there isn't quite the gravitas and the sort of constitutional implications of it that you get here. So it's much more of a celebrity story, if you will, and obviously very deeply meaningful to people, but just the tone is quite different. I do get calls from my American relatives. Look at that? Have you seen all the bling? Look at all the gold. What? Well, that looks amazing. So I can report my American family a big fan of all the costuming.
I see. We'll be taking a look at the reaction to the Queen's death later on in this episode of the Media Podcast. But let's turn to a different US story for now. And it's about the Emmy TV Awards that took place this week. Of course, buoyed all across film, all across TV. What did you make of this year's awards?
I jokingly tweeted the next day that, as ever, the voters for the Emmys got everything absolutely right. Because even though there, you know, stuff like Succession winning best drama, absolutely, you know, fantastic show. Ted Lasso, which I love, second year running, winning best comedy, etc. Broadly, there were some, you know, I mean, there are dozens of categories. I won't go through them all now.
Do it.
But I have to say, fans of Better Call Saul, like me, which is, as everyone knows, the greatest TV drama of the last 5 years at least, are still reeling in shock that it was snubbed and has not won any Emmy Awards whatsoever. Although the only caveat, the only hope, is that the last six episodes of the whole show are eligible for next year's Emmys. So we're all hoping community, the Better Call Saul community, fan community, who is outraged by the lack of award attention that the show's got so far in its history, we're at least looking forward to that. I would say one thing about award ceremonies, though, is that you've got to let them make their speeches in full. It's really annoying me now how, you know, every single winner of the Emmys was standing there looking at the countdown clock. They had a minute. By the time they got on stage, All you want to see in an award ceremony is the winner explaining how they feel after they've won. And I know they're going to thank their, you know, acupuncturist, etc., but you just have to deal with that.
So I totally see your point of view, Boyd, but I'm also terrified of the prospect of award ceremonies becoming even longer than they actually are. But if you looked at the Nielsen ratings for the Emmys, they reported an all-time low of below 6 million viewers. And of course, it's not just the case with the Emmys. We've had it with the Brit Awards as well, and the Oscars doing slightly better than this year. But of course, it was at a historic low last year. I mean, why do you think that award ceremonies are just not resonating with viewers as they might have done so in the past?
Well, I think in general, they're a victim of all big TV events slightly being on the decline due to the proliferation of streamers, etc. You know, it's an obvious point, but you know, there's just so much more competition now for these big live TV events, both here and in the States. So I think it would almost be surprising if figures weren't declining for this kind of show. But having said that, there is also the added factor that generally, you know, the winners of the big film and TV awards are looking for quality, and you know that it's supposed to be a recognition of excellence rather than sheer volume of viewers. So the winners tend to be slightly dominated by slightly more esoteric shows. The White Lotus, which quite rightly won Best Miniseries, is a phenomenal show and easily the best show in that category. But it's quite a challenging, you know, kind of ride of a watch. Not a mainstream proposition, I would say.
Karen, are you a Emmys follower? Were there anything that popped out from the awards this year?
I think it's interesting. I was going to add to Boyd's comment that I think one of the things that's happening is not necessarily that the numbers have gone down, but maybe people are consuming Emmy's content in a quite different way. I personally consumed it on Twitter the morning after, as I think a lot of people did. And what you'll find, I think, is fan communities for individual shows highlighting and resharing the reels that relate to the program that they particularly care about or the performer they particularly care about. And that was kind of how I enjoyed it. I particularly enjoyed the, I can't remember the actress's name, but the actress from White Lotus who just refused to get off the stage and just had a little dance. That was
Jennifer
fun.
Coolidge.
Absolutely brilliant. So enjoyed her. So I think that's what's happening, and I think that's what's happening interestingly for news overall and for all types of content this way. We consume it in bite-sized content suitable for whatever our interests happen to be pushed out to us, which I think actually is kind of a shame because it means you don't get that exposure to the programs you aren't already watching. So it's probably not the best way of consuming awards content, because the idea of an award should be to point you to excellent work that you otherwise wouldn't see, but that's the world we live in.
You make a very good point, because actually thinking about it, I could have stayed up and watched the Emmys all night, or I ended up doing just scrolled through Twitter for 2 minutes and then went, oh, that one, oh, that one, oh, that one,
exactly.
And then just moved on And I guess for millions of people, that was the same case for them. The knockout winner, as just mentioned, was Warner Brothers' White Lotus, a social satire about a tropical resort. It picked up 10 prizes, including Best Limited Series, Best Writing, Directing, Supporting Actor and Actress. However, it's not all rosy at Warner Brothers Discovery. Axios reported earlier this week that hundreds of staff are imminently expected to be laid off. Karen, what do you make of the reports about Warner Brothers Discovery?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, it's always challenging when two big properties integrate together, and it's not at all uncommon that you would see layoffs, just because part of the reason to bring two big enterprises together is, A, you get the assets, but B, you're then trying to rationalise and find efficiency. So it's not necessarily surprising that they'd be looking across the business levels to strip out some of the staff. Having said all of that, I think it also is worth us just humbly remembering that award-winning content does not always equal commercially successful content. HBO produces fantastic work, and I think it's at the top of its game right now. But whether that's the right business decision or whether they've got a successful long-term model, it waits to be seen. I think Discovery, what's great about them is they do have kind of a better hold on their audience, so they keep their audiences for longer. And I think that commercial opportunity of tapping into that audience and keeping people a little bit longer and then supporting it with HBO's kind of really flagship programs, that might in the end be a better model, but I think there's going to be some teething pains before they get there.
I'm going to bring you in and Boyd in on this, because you know you're a TV critic like me. Do you sort of think you look at Discovery's content and then you look at HBO's content and you see them so polarizing apart that you think it can be pretty impossible to bring them all together under one cohesive company?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you're right about that they're very different propositions. But if you look at the Disney Plus model, Disney Plus essentially is a portal. I'm literally talking about the interface, you know, with the viewer and the service, the streaming service. And you go onto Disney Plus and they categorize, you know, there's lots of different segments within Disney Plus for Marvel shows, you know, for Disney shows, old-fashioned Disney shows, for adult shows, the Star banner, you know, they put all their kind of adult stuff into that section. So you could imagine a HBO Discovery Plus platform, which is, I mean, this is basically what's going to happen. I mean, this is literally what's going to happen, where you go into it and you've got your Discovery bit and your HBO bit and maybe subdivided to a couple of other areas. So I think it'll be fine. Obviously, it's awful, absolutely awful for the people who are being victims of these two huge companies coming together. But I do think the whole streaming world, conglomerations of streaming services, is inevitable, isn't it, really? Because there are so many of them. It is really difficult for the consumer to work out what the hell's going on with streaming services. You know, it's inevitable. I just think, you know, I'm sure this will happen again. I'm sure there'll be more of them being brought together under single banners. But as to your point, the interesting thing that Karen mentioned about HBO is still extraordinarily, even with the rise of all its rivals in terms of streaming, HBO Max versus Netflix and Disney Plus, etc., it's still making the best stuff. The model has been for decades now for HBO that quality will sell, and they've really gone for it from The Sopranos onwards. So I think the new owners need to think about what they do with HBO, because it's a much cherished brand for sure.
And Karen, do you think sort of like the golden days of streaming services having huge growth, you know, the whole peak TV streaming moment, do you think that because of Discovery is having a bit of a tumultuous time, it might indicate that maybe the golden age is coming to an end?
I see it slightly differently. I think growth might slow, but not necessarily because some sort of golden age is coming to an end. I mean, there comes a point where you've just maxed out your available audience, right? What we've been happening over the last decade or so has been an evolution of people changing their viewing habits from live and terrestrial TV or even digital TV more and more towards the streaming services. At some point, you've got all of the available audience. There's not that much room for growth. And then it becomes a consolidation battle between which streaming service is going to win out. And I think, you know, it does make sense. You know, if I were in the C-suite thinking about my long-term plan, I'd be looking for which properties I could acquire, which streaming services I could amalgamate together, because you want to be the go-to channel and the go-to discovery portal. I think it's the more different types of content you have in the portal, the better, because viewers go into their viewing experience with different needs in mind. You know, sometimes you want to wake up and you just want to, you know, maybe this is just me, but sometimes you wake up and you just want to binge home programs and property shows. Sometimes you want to watch some prestige drama, and sometimes you're ready for an Oscar-winning film. If you can find that in one place, you're going to be a lot more loyal than if you're switching between platforms. So I think that's just, it's just the inevitability of where we are in the marketplace right now.
You have somehow predicted my afternoon of binging home property shows. Karen, somehow.
You know, it's a guilty pleasure.
Well, truly, that is much what I love about watching TV. Let's move on to talking about social media. I mean, the US has another major voting event coming up. It's 2 months to go until the midterm elections, and social media companies are ramping up fact checks, voting guides, and rolling out fresh features. Karen, could you paint us a picture? What's the mood like ahead of the midterms?
Sure. So the background is, normally in a midterm election, you would expect the president's party to lose in the midterm election. So if the president holds, you know, one or both houses of Congress, typically the president would either, the president's party would either lose those or at least lose some seats in those houses. And that is still most likely. But right now, what we're seeing is a shift in the polls in the Democrats' favor. And the reason for that, interestingly, seems to be that Republicans have been nominating candidates that are quite extreme, that are on the far right. And there is, of course, and this is going to touch on to what the media companies are trying to cope with right now, there are, in about half the states of the U.S. right now, Republican candidates who explicitly don't believe that the last presidential election was validly won by Joe Biden, and have explicitly made statements about that they think Donald Trump should still be president, that they would make changes to state law to try and make it easier for future election thefts to take place, so that would not happen. That's a huge challenge, because when the candidates themselves are promoting false information and misinformation and outright lies, the media has to decide about whether they report that information, which is, you know, electorally relevant information to voters, or whether they suppress it because it is dangerous misinformation. So it's a really poisonous media environment right now.
I mean, you make a very good point about just in regards to the actual people standing for election making falsehoods. And of course, you see the large media companies trying to go and implement changes to kind of combat this. So, for example, Twitter and TikTok have banned ads for candidates about political issues. Google and Facebook are allowing them, but are requiring disclosure for who pays. I mean, like, Boyd, do you think that it should be down to each social media company to set their own rules? Or do you think that there should be more of a kind of a blanket regulation about how these things are conducted?
I'm quite wary of blanket regulation, I have to say, particularly in this area, because, you know, it might be the kind of liberal left, if you like, position that obviously a lot of these ads are going to be, particularly the extreme right-wing candidates that Karen's talking about, are going to be spewing absolute nonsense in their advertising, which is, I'm sure, is the case. But equally, you know, once you start interfering into that level, you kind of obliterate the whole point of social media in a way, if you're going to censor it to that extent. I think, for example, I always think of the Hunter Biden laptop story, right, which was effectively censored by social media, these big social media companies, in the run-up to the last presidential election. Now, subsequently, the heads of these social media companies have admitted that they censored it. Now, I think that completely backfired, because it feels like, to the average, I think, American, it feels like you're being manipulated. I think that feels inherently wrong. And I also think they're worrying, overthinking it too much. If they had just have let that story be reported and pointed out factually, you know, exactly what was going on with it and how little it mattered, you know, is the bigger picture, then I think they overthink what they should be doing a lot when it comes to nonsensical stories, and that they should really let them, you know, they should absolutely let them be reported, point out when stuff is factually incorrect, and have more confidence, I think, in letting the truth get out.
Karen, do you reckon that there is too much overthinking?
It's a challenging situation. I don't think there is any one regulation that you can impose or one rule you could apply consistently that would make the media environment any less toxic than it is. I think the challenge I would give to the social media companies is that they've been acting reactively, sporadically, in an ad hoc way, kind of making up rules as and when a new situation arrives. I think they're well overdue for somebody to go back and actually do a lot more thinking on a lot more considered basis about what is the role of social media platforms? What are the risks and opportunities here? I think to your point, Boyd, about the Hunter Biden laptop story, if we're talking about a mainstream media environment reporting on that story, I think your point is right. If we're talking about, which is what we were mostly talking about on social media platforms, a network of entities making up things tangentially related to that story, accelerating it, exacerbating it. There's this kind of weird melange of sort of half-truths, quasi-truths, the ability to put things directly into people's feed. I don't think there's an easy answer, but I think the social platforms have been a lot too reactive. Well, I actually do think that the last election was a little smoother than the election before that. But I still think it requires a lot more consideration about what are the limits and potential of these platforms in this world.
Well, I'm sure that we'll be returning to this subject throughout the midterms. Let's have a look at something closer to home. Google is under pressure. This week, the European law firm Gerardin Partners announced plans to file a $25 billion ad tech lawsuit against the company on behalf of new publishers in the UK and the EU. Boyd, the social media companies have had several major lawsuits held against them. Do you think it's opportunistic? Do you think that Google and other companies are really accountable for damage to the newspaper industry and the magazine industry too?
Well, I have to preface what I'm about to say by making it quite clear. I don't really understand what's going on with this case, but the detail of it.
No, I like that. I like being honest here.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I am aware, whenever I speak, certainly within the company I work for and, you know, the magazine I work for, wherever I speak to people in advertising in our company, and it's been going on for years. It feels fundamentally, there's something fundamentally unfair about the extent to which Google and its parent company kind of operates with the ad tech that is used with online advertising, and that they are allegedly, I don't want to get sued, countersued, can you imagine, by Google, because I've misunderstood what they do. But they seem to have an enormous amount of influence and power when it comes to the online advertising world. And it's also a search engine, you know, obviously, that we all know about that. But there seems to be that whole area, it does seem fundamentally, possibly unfair.
I mean, Boyd makes a very good point about the fact of this story doesn't feel like it's anything new. It's been rumbling along for years, Karen. What do you make of this? I mean, do you think that there will be any kind of consequence, or do you think this will just be another topic that will be discussed in a year's time and nothing will be done?
Well, I think in defense of Boyd not knowing what's going on, I think partly we haven't seen the case laid out by the lawyers behind this. So yet we don't yet know the fact base that they're using to make their claim. I think if you look at the data at the level of output, it's very clear that there has been a huge erosion of ad revenue from media enterprises, from publishers to Google over the past couple of decades. The decline in newspaper and media revenues completely correlates with Google's overtaking it and other Facebook as well, other entities. Does that feel unfair? Yeah, I think especially if you're a publisher, it probably does. Is it done unlawfully? I don't have enough information yet to say. I think the claims that were made in the previous case had to do with Google's strategy of buying up ad tech tools and positioning itself as both the intermediary to ad purchases and the ad seller itself. Now, that could potentially be seen as a monopoly, but it would depend on, you know, how we interpret the laws. And I think that's a very nuanced thing. So I think Google could well win, could well lose, it could go either way. But I think no matter what happens, it's unlikely to reverse this trend, because I think it's sadly probably is a lot more than just Google behaving unfairly. I think it probably is just that the landscape has changed and they have a very successful commercial model.
For this week's deep dive, we're taking you into the offices of the UK radio bosses via the wonderful Radio Academy podcast. Their host, Christian Hugill, sat down with three radio chiefs to find out how they adapted the stations in response to the sad news of the Queen's death. Here's Tim Level, Director of Programmes for Times Radio, describing how the station responded. Later, you'll hear Rebecca Frank, Content Director for KISS FM.
We genuinely did not know that the Queen had sadly passed on until the tweet from the royal family arrived at 6:30. That was the first kind of confirmation. We had no kind of behind the scenes confirmation, nothing until 6:30, which is perhaps, you know, right and proper. What I would say is that we had thoughts that there might be an announcement firstly at 3 o'clock and then 6 o'clock, well, actually 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock. So we geared up and did a couple of things slightly differently at the top of those hours in case the announcement came, which didn't happen. But we then had, we had John Pienaar on air alongside Stig Abel, who'd come in to doublehead the show because of the series of the situation. And we got the news at 6:30. We had the script already printed out. And John Pienaar just read the kind of announcement. In fact, I gather that Times Radio was the first national radio station to broadcast the announcement of the Queen's death. And we had a sort of protocol all arranged where there'd be a short intro going into a recorded obit of about 4 minutes, which would give us, you know, a bit of space then to work out what we wanted to do. And from there, our coverage rolled onwards.
Rebecca, Nick, for music radio stations and stations that don't have as much news emphasis as Times, the gear changed to break news as momentous as this is huge. The same question to both of you, and coming to you first, Rebecca. How much notice did you get before realising you'd have to dramatically change the sound of the station, and how did you go about doing that?
We're obviously at the complete polar opposite end editorially to Tim, not only as a music radio station, but just due to the mood-based, uplifting, non-speech nature of what we do. In terms of the amount of time, I think we all had the same information at the same time. We have, you know, WhatsApp groups set up across the business to make sure that news and people in the know in the business can feed in both that kind of message from the palace that allowed us all to take that as, time to get prepared. There could be something, you know, more substantial coming later on. But at that point, we took everything at face value, but just chose it as a moment to cancel a few meetings, frankly, at that point, at sort of 1:30 when that news came out. But I think everybody got the news at the same time. And we obviously sort of took guidance from news as they could sort of see what was happening down the wires as it got closer to the official announcement time. So we did start to tone down, but not sort of dramatically, that we didn't want to sort of give a sense to our audience that we knew something they didn't and be sort of facetious. At the same time, there were just some features that we took a decision. I took the decision would have been uncomfortable to have juxtaposed with a potential announcement. So, you know, we kept our advertising was still running. Our upbeat music on a Thursday afternoon was still running. I would say as it got closer to when we actually did the announcement, when our news teams advised us there could be something fairly imminent, that's when, you know, links were dropped and we made sure there were no sort of clangers, we would call them at KISS, no music that would be insensitive juxtaposed. So, you know, fairly, I would say we actually had quite a lot of time in terms of using the spidey sense of what that palace announcement might have meant underneath the exterior. We just took some sensible decisions without hoodwinking the audience. Frankly, we're still a young orientated station on a Thursday afternoon.
That was Tim Level and Rebecca Frank being interviewed by Christian Hugh Gill. You can hear their full conversation, which also features Nick Pitts from Jazz FM, on the Radio Academy podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, of course. It's time for a short break. We'll be back after this with our guests' thoughts on how the media reacted to the Queen's death.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And we're back. I still have Boyd Hilton and Karen Robinson with me. Of course, it's just been over a week since the sad news of the death of Her Majesty the Queen, and the media has responded, as you would expect, in a big way. We've been having a look at TV coverage set out for next Monday's funeral, and all Sky channels, all of the ITV network will be simulcasting the funeral. BBC One and BBC Two are airing it too. Channel 4, I think the only network, as of the time that we're recording this, yet to announce their plan. I mean, Boyd, just as someone who watches a lot of TV, do you think that this is kind of too much even? Do you think this is actually something that Republicans might be frustrated that there aren't any alternative programming out there?
You know, essentially I consider myself to be Republican, but I'm not that bothered because I think, you know, there's Netflix, you know, there are actually dozens of alternative things to watch, even within the BBC, because as you say, it's BBC One and BBC Two, but there are other BBC's other outlets, there's iPlayer. You'll be able to find stuff to watch if you don't want to watch the Queen's funeral. But I also think the assumption that certainly a non-royalist or a Republican or whatever you want to put it isn't interested in the event itself anyway is misguided, because I'm fascinated by it as a huge historical moment. And we'll be watching from that point of view. I think it's a slightly odd gesture by ITV and Sky to have all their channels showing it. I don't quite understand. You know, it doesn't feel like something that they needed to do or people were expecting them to do. And I wonder almost slightly cynically, because with these occasions, the vast majority of viewers do traditionally go to the BBC. I wonder whether this is, you know, ITV and Sky's effort. Well, if all of their channels show this thing, then they'll get at least more of a share of people watching. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And no doubt reports will show the extent to which the percentage of people who watched it on BBC versus ITV versus Sky, it might boost those figures for them. That is very cynical of me. It's interesting that Channel 4 haven't announced what they're doing. I think that's fascinating because they did, you know, they certainly covered the death of the Queen and subsequent events almost as in depth and spent almost as much airtime on it as, you know, as its rival channel, certainly. But certainly they covered it in some depth. So I'll be fascinated to see what they do.
Well, I think Channel 5 actually said that they were going to be showing children's programmes on Monday during the day. But then I think Dan Walker, of course, joined quite recently, is going to be doing an extended news. Karen, how do you see the way that the media has reacted to the Queen's death? Do you think it reflected the gravitas of the situation? Do you think it was overblown? What's your take?
I have complicated views on it. I think, first of all, I just want to pay homage to the brilliant people who have been delivering the coverage. I happen to have a couple of friends who have been working behind the scenes at various different media enterprises to prepare for this moment. I know that it's been a project that has been many years in the planning, and I know how hard they've been working very, very quietly to make everything run very, very smoothly. And I think my view is they did a phenomenal job. The quality of the coverage was, it hit the right tone, it had the right gravitas while still being compelling viewing. So quality, I think, has been excellent. I think Hugh Edwards is personally my new king because he has been absolutely stellar in a very challenging brief. So wonderful quality of coverage. In terms of quantity, I think that even though, as Boyd says, this is a subject of some universal interest, especially in the UK, but also around the world. So it's absolutely right that there was quite a lot of coverage. But there was a YouGov poll recently that came out that asked people this question directly. Do you think there's been too much, not enough, or about the right amount of coverage of this event? And interestingly, the plurality of opinion was towards too much. 49% of people said there's been a little too much. 42% said about the right amount. So, you know, reasonably balanced, but skewing on the side of saying, okay, that's enough now. Only 2% said there'd been not enough coverage. And I don't know what those 2% thought they would have liked to see additionally. Maybe they would have liked Netflix to be switched off so that there was no other alternative. But yeah, I think, I think though, I'm not surprised at all from a strategic point of view that every media enterprise would err on the side of showing too much. I don't necessarily think, I disagree with Boyd, I don't think they were trying to claim an advantage over the competitors. I suspect it was pure reputational risk. I think they were very concerned that their institutional stakeholders would punish them if they didn't give enough weight and merit and quantity of coverage to this, that they felt that the risks of being seen to be anything less than perfectly respectful were too serious for an organization operating in this climate. So I think that was probably the right call, that it's better to err on the side of too much than too little, because there's very little to gain from being the first to break away.
I think there is a fear among, you know, these, the TV companies, of being accused of doing the wrong thing, yeah, of showing disrespect. I think that is that fear, which, let's face it, comes from certain newspapers, I feel, yeah, you know, and kind of right-wing outlets, is genuine. And I don't blame them. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you're right about that. I still think not every single of their channels showing the funeral live, and no one would have, very few people would really have batted an eyelid. But yeah, I do get the point absolutely about the worries they legitimately have about how they're going to be accused of whatever by certain parties.
What I also found interesting is that I was reading a report by Jim Watson in The Guardian that compared the amount of complaints received about the coverage to the death of Prince Philip. And whilst Prince Philip had received more than 100,000 complaints, the Queen, in regard to the Queen, I think the BBC had only received about 640, 670, which I think maybe indicates an understanding by the British public of, you know, this will obviously interrupt the schedules in a big way. We've also seen over the course of the last week, focus on queues and queuing, which of course is an incredible British phenomenon. Have you been glued to the DCMS footage of how long the queue is, the what three words, the Queen lying in state? I'm sort of intrigued by what you think of these new developments.
Do you know what? I absolutely loved it. I think the queue is, I'm enjoying that almost more than the pageantry, because it just feels so much more human and so much more relatable. It also really made me reflect upon just the enormous distance in time between Queen Elizabeth's coronation and her death. Because, of course, famously, her coronation was a very huge media moment for Britain, in that it's, you know, famously, it was it was broadcast on television for the first time. It was the reason a lot of people bought television. So it was kind of a spur to the creation of a world of media in this country. It really feels like media has come just, I mean, it's a space exploration from in the 70 years that she's been in power. So it's really, it kind of seemed appropriate to me to reflect about how we're using these new tools to commemorate her passing, just as we brought on board television as a new tool to celebrate her coronation. I quite liked that, actually.
I agree with Karen about the queue. I live quite near London Bridge, and I went to look at the queue the other day, and I feel that there should be a queue of people watching the queue, in a way, because it's fascinating and to see the people lining up, and to see just how many people, the sheer volume and numbers. And I wanted to echo what Karen said about the people. Oh my God, the broadcasters, when it came home to me, the challenge they face to literally just talk incessantly for hours on end was when the cortege of the Queen in the cars traveling from Scotland, you know, one part of Scotland to another, taking hours and hours and hours. And the BBC and ITV, the commentators, just had to talk about that with a helicopter shot following the car for hours on end. And that really brought home, you know, that That is an incredible task. And one more shout out to ITV, because people do assume that, you know, people do go to the BBC. I think Tom Bradby on ITV has been a really good anchor for this. I think it's slightly less formal and slightly than the BBC, I would say, as you might expect from ITV. So I think they've done a really good job themselves. Slightly less pompous than Nicholas Witchell, may I say, in terms of royal correspondence as well. dare I say. So I think they've done a good job.
Yeah, 100%. Just to give a little bit of colour to that, I happen to have a friend who is a former royal correspondent for a newspaper and now is a freelancer. She lives near me, bumped into her husband taking their daughter to school. She's in school with my daughter. And I stopped and said to him, "How's she doing?" And he said, "Oh, I haven't seen her. She sent a taxi to collect her clothes," because, you know, she couldn't, you know, obviously it happened. She had to rush out, couldn't get a change of clothes. And I think that's what we're seeing is dozens, if not hundreds of people not seeing their families, walking a tightrope, realizing that if they say one thing wrong, frankly, all hell could break loose, and having to be constantly dignified, constantly respectful, keep the conversation going, try to be informative in some way. I mean, I just take my hat off to them. I think it's such an impressive piece of work that they've done across all channels, really.
And certainly one that will be remembered and looked back on in all documentaries looking back at this historic period. And of course, we thought that in our own little bit of reflection for the Queen's life, this week's media quiz is dedicated to remembering some of Her Majesty's favourite media. The same rules apply, in which Boyd, if you want to answer, Boyd, you say
Boyd.
There's a slightly delicious pause there. And Karen, you will say
Karen.
Okay, great. So it's basically a quick game of true or false. So off we go. Question number one. The Queen sent a handwritten note to Strictly Come Dancing performers praising their fantastic performance. True or false?
Boyd, I think it's false.
It's actually true. JJ Chalmers, ex-Marine and son of the Queen's former chaplain, told Hugh Edwards that she sent him a handwritten note saying that she enjoyed watching Strictly Come Dancing with him on it. So there you go. Question number two. The Queen might have enjoyed watching Strictly, but was not a fan of dancing herself. True or false?
Karen. That's false. I understand she loved a bit of ABBA.
Well, she did love a little bit of ABBA. That's not the answer I've got here, but I would just say that is fact. In our Queen 90 musical years, her cousin Lady Elizabeth Anson said her Majesty enjoyed the dance floor, had great rhythm, and was a huge fan of musical theatre show tunes. So I guess ABBA the musical would be applicable to that. Question number three. We're halfway there. Boyd, still a chance for you to win. The Queen loved the sitcom The Cumars at Number 42. True or false?
Karen. Boyd.
Oh, wow, straight in. Oh, Karen's just there first.
That is true. I'm delighted to report that is, I think, her favourite sitcom.
It is true. According to BBC journalist Phil Jones, she had memorised some of the lines from Mira Sayal's grandmother character. So it's amazing, genuinely amazing. Question number four. The Queen's favourite Christmas movie was a sci-fi Flash Gordon. True or false?
Boyd.
Boyd is true.
Yeah, which I love. The idea of the Queen watching one of the campus films in motion picture history is a joy.
I think I heard a great story. I have no idea whether it's true, that somebody told me this week, that apparently the Queen wanted to leave an event early so that she can go home and watch an episode of Twin Peaks. Which
I think it's
just also
fabulous.
Yeah, phenomenal. But that's not a question in this quiz, though.
No.
But yes, according to the Flash Gordon one, it is true. According to Brian Blessed, he claims the Queen reveals to him that she watches the movie with her grandchildren every Christmas and even asked him to say Gordon's alive to please them. Goodness.
I just love that.
Truly. Well, there's no outright winner to this week's media quiz, so I guess in a way you both lose. So that is the media quiz. That is the media podcast for this week. My thanks to Boyd Hilton and Karen Robinson. May I just say, it's been a joy to present, because I used to listen to the media show back in the Guardian days in its previous iteration. Never would I thought I'd be presenting the media podcast. So what a thrill. If you've enjoyed this episode, it would be amazing if you could do these two things. Firstly, tell your colleagues and friends about this show on Twitter or LinkedIn, and become a patron of the show at patreon.com/mediapod. You'll be able to access an archive of all of our interviews and loads of guests with the latest and greatest media analysis. That's patreon.com/mediapod. And of course, follow us to hear new episodes when they drop on your podcast app of choice. There are many podcast apps of choice. Subscribe at podfollow.com/themediapodcast. My name is Scott Bryan. You can follow me on Twitter at @ScottyGB. I'm also on the Must Watch podcast on BBC Sounds every Monday. The producer was Phoebe Adler-Ryan, and it was a Rethink Audio production. We'll see you next week.